from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. At a time when it feels like every place has already been explored, Joshua Ford, Dylan Thuris, and Ella Morton are here to make you rethink where and how you travel. Their new book, Atlas Obscura, is filled with hundreds of hidden gems from around the world, distilled from more than 10,000 entries on their website of the same name. Their book opens by saying, many of the places in this book are in no way tourist sites and should not be treated as such. They are more a cabinet of curiosities meant to inspire wanderlust and wanderlust. So let's find out where and what they are. Good morning, Dylan Thuris.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. He's co-founder of Atlas Obscura and the co-author of the book Atlas Obscura. We're also joined by Ella Morton, co-author of Atlas Obscura and the associate editor of the Atlas Obscura website. Good morning, Ella Morton.
Hi there.
Hi, and we're also joined by Joshua Ford. He's co-founder of Atlas Obscura, and he also is the author of Moonwalking with Einstein, about how he became the U.S. memory champion. And I know we're supposed to be talking about sites, but Joshua Ford, what is the U.S. memory champion, really quickly?
He's the person who can remember more stuff more quickly than anybody else in the country.
Wow, that's amazing.
And when, I was briefly him.
When did you win that? And it's always a dude?
No, it's not always a dude, actually. I shouldn't have said guy or gal. That was in 2006, and then I wrote this book, Moonwalking with Einstein, about it.
Well, that is a pretty amazing honor, I have to say, and enviable. I want to start with you, Joshua Ford, if I could, because I think some of the – we asked all three of you to send us sort of your top five favorite places to travel, and I think some of the sites that you mentioned particularly reflect what I read at the intro, which is these are in no way tourist sites, but more a cabinet of curiosities. So can you share with us your top site that you would recommend folks to check out?
Well, it's awfully hard to pick a number one top site, but I'll tell you about a fun one. So, you know, there is a Buddhist monk called Shinayokai who mummified himself to death in 1783. And this was a not uncommon practice in Japan from like the 11th century until the 20th century. People would mummify themselves to death. And it was a kind of extreme act of Buddhist self-denial. And it involved this like 10-year-long regimen of effectively lacquering your own body until your body gave up. And they would take these mummified monks and put them on display. And this particular monk I just mentioned, Shinayokai, is one of 16 self-mummified monks that you can find in temples all over northern Japan.
Wow. That is really incredible. And, you know, this sounds bad, but Ella Morton, this reminds me of one of your top sites, the Necropants. Can you describe what that is, or top oddities?
Oh, my goodness. The Necropants. It's quite a story. So this is an exhibit at the Icelandic Museum of Witchcraft and Sorcery, which is a few hours outside Reykjavik. But they're a pair of pants. And the story behind it is that they are a luck-attracting garment that was used in about the 17th century. And the story is pretty gruesome, I have to warn you, but it began with
That's a good disclaimer for our listeners.
You're
kind of gross.
Don't be listening to this while you're eating. But it began with you would approach a male acquaintance and ask if you could have the bottom half of their skin once they were dead. And when they then expired, you would dig them up, take off their skin from the waist down, making sure to keep it in one piece, and then you would don those skin pants yourself. And the next step, once you had the skin pants on, was to steal a coin from a poor widow, which to me just seems excessive. Like, why would you have to target someone who was already poor? But that's apparently what you need for the luck of the Necropants. But you would place a coin in the front pocket of the Necropants, and then the idea was that this coin would attract more coins. So you would become rich by walking around wearing someone else's skin with a coin in the pocket. And we've not been able to confirm whether this did actually happen back in 17th century Iceland, but the curators at the Icelandic Museum of Witchcraft and Sorcery are convinced that this actually did occur.
That's pretty incredible. And this is this a small museum or a you know, well-known museum in Iceland?
I wouldn't say it's very known. It's one of these small establishments run by people who are very passionate about what they do. And there are so many of these types of places that we celebrate in the book. Places like there's a woman in Independence, Missouri, who has a museum devoted to Victorian hair art. So there are all these bracelets and necklaces and little charms made from woven hair of people from the Victorian era. And these are the kinds of museums that we adore. I know Dylan has definitely been to a lot of these museums across America.
Dylan Thuris, was I reading right that it was a shared love of these types of museums and outsider art that brought you and Joshua together to create Atlas Obscura?
That's right. We worked on a previous project together, but in doing that, we discovered that we really shared this passion for, you know, tiny museums tucked away that are only open on Tuesdays, you know, the crochet museum where every object is crocheted. And I was heading off to go live in Eastern Europe for a year. And we started talking about these kinds of places in general, not just small museums, but outsider art projects and, you know, things that just were left out of traditional guidebooks and how hard it was to find these kinds of places. And basically, it started as a passion project for the two of us. We wanted a guide for ourselves so that when we went somewhere, we could find the stuff we wanted to see that we found so interesting and incredible. So that's how it all began.
And tell us what is among your top five for unique or weird places that are worth visiting.
Yeah, so one of the places that I sort of cherish the most having ever been is a place called the Quechua Chaca in Peru. It's about 4 hours outside of Cusco. And it's also known as the Last Incan Bridge. And it's woven entirely out of grass. So it's a 50-foot suspension bridge over a, you know, raging river below. And imagine a kind of Indiana Jones-style bridge hanging there. And the way it's made is, each year, four villages come together and they take this local grass. It's sort of like hay. And they weave that into twine and they weave that twine into ropes. And they've been making this bridge in this exact same way year after year for over 500 years. It's basically an unbroken piece of the Incan road empire, which once stretched all over South America. So it's this kind of incredible engineering feat. It's this visually amazing place. And then culturally, there's not much like it, this kind of unbroken history.
It sounds incredible. And in the billboard to this show, I read about basically a 200-foot pit in Turkmenistan or in the desert of Turkmenistan that's been on fire for 45 years was also one of your top five. What is that, Dylan Thuris?
Yeah, that's for sheer you can't believe you didn't know it existed until someone tells you about it. It's got to be up there. So this is a place called the Gates of Hell or the Door to Hell. And it is in the Turkmenistan desert, and it was created as basically an industrial accident in the 1970s. So in 1971, a Soviet petroleum crew went down there looking for natural gas, and they found it, and they set up their rig. But it turns out they'd set it up over this huge crater. So when they started to drill, the entire rig fell in and made this gigantic 200-foot-wide hole. And they had a sort of a secondary problem, which is that this hole was leaking deadly natural gas. And so they did, you know, what I think made sense to them at the time, they lit it on fire. They expected it to burn for a few weeks or a few months and extinguish itself, but instead it has been on fire for over 45 years. So that is, it's the kind of place that I think is sort of a quintessential Atlas Obscura location. When you tell someone about it, they're like, how can this exist? And B, how have I never heard of it before?
Incredible. I should tell our listeners that we do have a photo of it, I believe, on our website. Ella Morton, what are the criteria for something being Atlas Obscura material? And the reason I ask you this is because I'm sure you were one of the folks who had the wonderful process of trying to narrow down from some 10,000 entries on your website to what should be in a book of about 700 or so.
Yes. I mean, so we, because Atlas Obscura began as a website, there's not a page limit. And so we have now about 10,000 places in the database. And in putting this book together, we had to select 700. So it was a very torturous process of having to figure out what goes in and what has to be jettisoned. And we had this giant spreadsheet, and we had to sort of find a balance between the geographical locations, because we wanted to have a good spread across the world, but also the categories. I mean, if you look in the index at the back, the categories are things like fiery places and mummies and micronations and crypts. So our view of what is an Atlas Obscura worthy place is, well, our basic criteria are that there is a fascinating story behind it. There is an element of the hidden, and there is an element of the surprising. So the classic example that we give is that the Eiffel Tower would not be an Atlas Obscura place, but the secret apartment that Gustav Eiffel built near the top of the Eiffel Tower, that he put plush carpeting inside, had a grand piano where he hosted his VIP guests, that would be an Atlas Obscura place.
And that's a place that's a place that can be visited?
It can be visited, yes. It was closed for a while, and you had to be a bit special to go there, but I think it is open again.
And can you tell us about the glowworm caves? Because that was on the top of your list. I made you go to NecroPants very early, so.
Yeah, well, the glowworm caves is magical in a whole different way. It's a place that I went when I was young, because they're located in New Zealand, in the middle of the North Island. And what happens is you go down into these caves that are pretty similar to your standard cave experience. You know, you've got your stalactites and stalagmites and, you know, nooks and crannies that you get taken through. But there's this one experience where you get put into a rowboat and rowed along a subterranean river where it's really, really dark. And then the guide tells you to look up. And what you see is what looks like a galaxy. It's all these twinkling lights on the ceiling, and each one of those lights is a bioluminescent fungus gnat in its larval stage. And these are creatures that are native to New Zealand. They bioluminesce, so they glow during a particular part of their life cycle. And if you look at photos of this place, it just looks like a galaxy. You can't quite tell what you're looking at. But that experience is so magical, and it made such an imprint on me when I was a child that it's just one of those wondrous experiences that absolutely belongs in this book.
And there is a picture of it in the book, and it does look pretty incredible. Joshua Foer, you had one on your list called The Tempest Prognosticator, and I don't know why Glowworm Caves reminded me of that, but can you explain what it is?
Yeah, well, so this is one of my personal favorites. You know, it used to be impossible to predict the weather, like even one day out. And in 1851, at the Great Exhibition in London, a English surgeon named George Meriwether unveiled this contraption that he said was going to revolutionize meteorology. And he called it the Tempest Prognosticator. Basically, Meriwether had noticed that in the lead-up to a large storm, that freshwater leeches would get kind of agitated, and he thought, I can build a weather prediction machine based on this. And so he created this elaborate kind of Victorian merry-go-round filled with freshwater leeches and attached the leeches to wires and the wires to bells, and when a storm was approaching, the whole thing would start buzzing. Now, tragically, this invention never really caught on.
But shockingly.
You can still find a working model, working, so to speak, model of the Tempest Prognosticator filled with leeches in one of these tiny museums that Atlas Obscura just exists to celebrate. It's called the Barometer World Exhibition, and it's in Devon, England.
You know, one thing that often comes up, Joshua Foer, when people are exposing these hidden gems or ruins, it's the question of whether or not exposing them actually kind of ruins them.
Right. Like your favorite band, once they start playing on the radio, it's like, have they been ruined? You know, we've been at this now for like 7 years, with the website at least. And during that span, we have seen a fair number of places cease to exist. Like go out of business, close down, just become so ruined they get condemned. And in our experience, the kinds of places that Atlas Obscura celebrates more often disappear from being underloved rather than overloved. And our hope is that we can help some of these places stay around, stay in business, stay open to the public by bringing new visitors to them.
Are there places out there, Dylan Thuris, that won't be there, that we should check out as soon as possible because they won't be there because of climate change?
Yeah. I mean, there are places that actually fall. Like the Mendenhall Ice Glacier is a place that basically – or so the both the glacier and there's an ice cave that forms. And you can't – I mean, it's unsafe to go there now in part because of global warming.
This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking with Ella Morton, Joshua Foer, and Dylan Thuris of Atlas Obscura, a website and now book that catalogs all the obscure places and experiences around the world, from sparkling glowworm caves in New Zealand to Cat Island in Japan. And we're asking you, our listeners, to join the conversation with your favorite obscurities, since they're not just places but also just experiences as well. And we're getting quite a few. Shad writes, please ask your guests about Glass Beach in Brooklyn. I visited a few years ago and found the place to be not only unique and almost magical, but interesting for the sheer number of antique bottles and other knickknacks one can find buried in the sand. Carl writes, in Basel, Switzerland, I saw a sign for a museum of coat hangers next door to a dry cleaner. It was a Sunday and it was closed, and I wasn't able to go in and see if it was real. And Neil suggests Dr. Evermore's Forevertron, which is 45 minutes outside Madison, Wisconsin. And according to the Forevertron website, it's a sculpture garden with fantastical machines made from salvaged factory parts. Joshua, Ella, Dylan, any of these you're familiar with?
I'm happy to say that two of them, Dead Horse Bay, which is the glass beach that was mentioned, and Dr. Evermore's Forevertron are both in the book. The Coat Hanger Museum, however, is not, and in fact may be new to us entirely.
But, sounds amazing.
Yeah, but the other two are well known and beloved. The Dead Horse Bay is one of these strange little places that's not that hard to get to. It takes about, you know, an hour on public transportation, and it's a turn-of-the-century landfill, essentially filled with these sort of late Victorian bottles. And eventually it burst, and, you know, all of that stuff kind of overflowed onto the beach, and it's still there today. And before that, it was the reason it's called Dead Horse Bay is it was a place for horse rendering. So you go to this beach, and you can find these beautiful antique bottles. But I also, when I was there a few years ago, found a little, you know, 130-year-old one-inch piece of horse bone as well. So it's pretty amazing, you know, preserve of New York history.
That's wonderful.
That sounds amazing.
You found one for him.
I believe we have that in this on the site. I don't think it made the book, but it's a good example of a category that, you know, is a part of this whole thing, which is outsider art, people who kind of take up a project and then devote often their whole lives to it. And sometimes these people go largely uncelebrated, unknown, but some of these projects are like truly incredible, beautiful creations.
And this is how Atlas Obscura works, right? You have folks suggesting places to your website all the time, and then you're deciding whether or not they sort of meet Atlas Obscura material. Joshua Foer?
Yeah, I mean, one of the surprising things is that the website is built on a kind of crowdsourced, user-generated, people submitting places. Like 99% of what people submit is spot on and belongs in the Atlas. People just get it, you know, what is Atlas-y, what belongs in Atlas Obscura. And obviously this is Peterson Rock Garden is totally Atlas-y.
Well, Vince comments, Joshua Foer, on something you mentioned. He says there's a working replica of the Tempest Prognosticator at the Great Dickens Christmas Fair in San Francisco.
Whoa.
That's awesome. That's
road trip.
I know. Did you know it was that easy to get to?
Please add that to Atlas Obscura if you wouldn't mind.
And John writes, I almost hate to ask, but can I get a location-sensitive Atlas Obscura app, or should I write one? Like an app that pings me when I'm within a certain mileage of a museum or experience? Dylan Thuris, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, get in touch with us. We hope such a thing will exist shortly, but help is always appreciated.
Well, Ben asks, are there any places that your guests visited that they felt were overhyped and they thought were a waste of time? Ella Morton, has that ever happened to you, or Joshua?
Oh, wow.
Like you got there and you're like,
I can't
like,
think of any off the top of my head.
I think some of it depends on what you go in expecting too. Like there's a place here in Manhattan called the Earth Room. And it's in Soho. It takes up, you know, the whole floor, the second floor of a Soho loft. And it's a room filled with basically around 300,000 pounds of dirt. And it's been there since the 1970s. It's an art project by Walter de Maria. And if you go in expecting something other – actually, in researching this, I went on Yelp. And I happened to look at some Yelp reviews of it. And there were people who were like – angry because it was just a room full of dirt. And it was a little like if you go to the dirt room and you don't expect the dirt room, you are going to be disappointed.
And
so it's – yeah.
Well, what I wanted to say was it gets to something that I've heard you say quite a bit, Dylan Thuris, which is Atlas Obscura almost teaches you another way of looking at the world. And can you kind of explain what you mean by that? I might be grossly misquoting you there, but something along those lines.
No, that's absolutely right. And part of the point of this whole thing is that, well, sometimes we talk about these super far-flung places, you know, in Turkmenistan, in Peru, you know, and they're easy to see. Oh, wow, that's really amazing. Part of the point is that a lot of these places are in your own backyard. They're literally around the corner from you. And the idea is that, in fact, the world is, like, rich in strange, incredible little hidden wonders and stories. But you have to sort of give yourself permission. Sometimes we call it sort of seeing through new eyes to really look and investigate. And you'd walk right by the Earth Room. But if you actually stopped and looked, you know, there's a little buzzer that says Earth Room. And all you have to do is press the button and they'll buzz you up. And then you're kind of face to face with this very odd, unusual experience in one of the most kind of crowded urban environments you can find. So our hope is to kind of give people that sense that this book taken collectively, all of these wonders all over the world, it isn't a bucket list so much as a way of trying to frame, say, look at what's out there and start to kind of explore your own little world with that same sense of curiosity.
Ella Morton, did you want to add anything to that? You've talked about looking at the world in an atlas-y way. What do you mean by atlas-y way?
I think it's mostly about the hidden stories that are right there that you just have to have someone point them out to you or just look a little bit closer. I mean, there are things like there's a temple in Tokyo that has a rock in the garden of it. And this rock is a memorial to insects that this artist named Masayama Sesai made in the 1820s. And he made it because he had put this biology textbook together in which he had killed insects to use as anatomy models for sketching them. And so he, you know, as a Buddhist, he respects all living things and he wanted to honor the insects who had given their lives for this biology textbook in the form of a memorial stone. And you could so easily walk past that just thinking, oh, it's a rock in a temple. But when you hear the story behind it, it's just adds so much. I mean, there are also things like in Boston, there's a plaque that is a memorial for the Great Molasses Flood of 1919, which is when a tank full of molasses burst and this torrent of sticky sludge burst forth into the streets and killed people. And there's not much there now except for a plaque. But when you know the story behind it, it's just so incredible that it really adds to your sense of the world.
Again, we're talking with Ella Morton, Dylan Thuris, and Joshua Foer of Atlas Obscura. Dylan Thuris, are you finding that people's sense of what constitutes a travel destination is changing?
Yes. Totally. I think the way people think about travel has changed enormously in the last 20 years. And it's kind of part of an evolution. But in some ways, travel has gotten easier. It's gotten easier to get to places and to get a little bit farther out. And I think people really, really want to have interesting experiences, kind of deep, meaningful experiences. They don't want to feel like they're sort of on this super prescribed path. And so I think the nice thing about that is that means that people are seeking out these unusual experiences and trying to have deep, deep travel, things happen that are meaningful to them and that they take back with them. I think we live in a very mediated world these days. So real experience becomes kind of exceptionally valuable.
And Joshua Foer, Atlas Obscura really puts on or creates experiences as well. I was reading about Into the Veil, which was something that you do in New York. Is that right? Can you describe that?
That's our annual 1,500 person. It's actually hard to describe. It's almost a performance art party held in the largest cemetery in Brooklyn every October. About 1,500 people show up, and we've got music playing in various mausoleums and tombs. We've got sort of strange things hidden around corners as you span out and explore the cemetery with us. We also do events every weekend in 8 cities around the country. And we've started just in the last month, actually, running our first international trips to places like Cuba, Iceland, Eastern Europe. And we're going to have a whole host of new destinations coming online in 2017.
Ella Morton, you know, reminding me from what Josh was saying about the cemetery experience that you create, that there are a lot of things related to death in your book. There are a lot of, like, crypts, the columbariums, mausoleum, you know, things that have a lot to do with death. And I'm wondering if that's deliberate or some kind of a theme with Atlas Obscura in some ways.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. When I think in the earlier days of Atlas Obscura, some people viewed us as a collector of the macabre and a sort of pointing and looking at things like bone churches and things of that nature. But we never want to point at things and say, oh, that's strange. You know, we're fascinated in how people see the world and what perspectives we can look at humanity from. And one of the most fascinating is how different people in different cultures view death. And that's one of the things in this book that we tried to get a wide range of perspectives on. There are things like the Mary Cemetery in Romania, where this guy spent decades making these blue wooden headstones that had funny poems and stories and captions about the people who died. And some of them actually featured images of the person in their death moment. So, like, literally a guy walking in front of a truck. But it was meant to be a sort of witty approach to the whole thing. It was meant to be celebratory. And then you have things like there's a coffin workshop in Ghana where, because of the culture there, they believe that once people have died, they still exert an influence over the living. So the way that you send them off in the funeral needs to be a big deal. It needs to impress them. So they'll do things like make a coffin out of something that reflects the person's interests in their life. So it might be a ballpoint pen for a teacher or a tiger or a mobile phone. And you can actually see one of these coffins. It's in the shape of a Nike sneaker. It's at the Brooklyn Museum. But yeah, I mean, that's just one of the things we do at Atlas Obscura is look at how many perspectives we can see the world from and not just assume that our way is the dominant way or the right way.
You've been listening to a special encore edition of Forum. Our guests were the co-founders of the popular website Atlas Obscura, Joshua Foer and Dylan Thuras, and the co-author of their new book Atlas Obscura, Ella Morton.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.